Hi everyone. Welcome to another episode of A New Kind of Celebrity. I'm your host Venal and I'm excited to bring you another inspiring and insightful conversation this week. At A New Kind of Celebrity, we define the word celebrity differently. We define it as someone worth celebrating. Our guests are people who are doing incredible work to make this world a better place. Join us as we celebrate these individuals and learn from their experiences, leadership, and wisdom. Our guest today is Deborah Levine. Deborah is the founder of the American Diversity Report, an award-winning author of 15 books, and one of Forbes magazine's Diversity and Inclusion Trailblazer. Deborah has 33 years' experience as a changemaker in challenging times. She's the designer of cognitive diversity using emotion metrics, neurocommunication, and decision optimization. With her considerable experience in program planning, community interface, teaching, and management, she designs diversity, equity, inclusion projects that boost inclusion efforts on multiple levels. Deborah has also founded Chattanooga's Women Council of Diversity. She has received awards from the Women's Federation for World Peace and the Nation for Women. Deborah, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation. I'm very excited to learn about your experience and your journey. Maybe you could start us off with walking us a little bit through your journey of how you came to work in the diversity space and what were the different things that influenced you on the way.
Sure. One of the things that strikes me when I think about the journey and how it began is that I wasn't even aware that it was beginning so young. I grew up in the British colony of Bermuda, a beautiful island that many people go visit as tourists, but it was home to me. But it was also the fact that I was the only Jewish little girl on the entire island. And my family is the only Jewish family on the island to have lived there for four generations. Now, I didn't realize this, of course, as a little one, but it must have sunk in about being different. And then when we came to the States, because my dad wanted us to have the experience of living in a Jewish community, it was quite a culture shock to go from Bermuda's 24 square miles to Long Island, New York, outside of Manhattan. It was tough. And you had to learn different ways of speaking English, different ways of expressing yourself. So it was a journey in terms of language and in terms of relationships. It was also a very different way of life. I had never seen a highway before, right? And I hated it. I hated it, every minute of it. And I explained that to my mother and father, who made an interesting decision. They decided to expose me to the beauties of America. And they took me downtown to Manhattan to see the museums, to see the music, to hear the music, to watch the ballet. I was a dancer. And I was just fascinated. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Madison Square Garden Rockettes. No? It's an American iconic group of dancers, and I was hooked. So it was through the arts in general that I made the transition culturally, not even realizing it. But it has been that way all my life. And when I do diversity training, I use the arts always because they resonate at an intellectual level as well as a subconscious level in ways that give us windows into cultures that we might never open otherwise. So I have a background as a dancer. I've had my own dance company. I played the violin and performed, right? And of course, as a writer, I have published 15 books. I'm a newspaper columnist. I'm in the process of writing a TV pilot script about my life.
Wow.
And when you think about that, all these different genres of writing, right, is like diversity. You have to learn and relearn, unlearn, and try again and again. But the process is so built into me from the early days that it's just who I am.
That's really interesting. And I think you spoke a little bit about maybe right from childhood, somewhere it's seeping in subconsciously that you were different, being the only Jewish family on the islands. But were there any other incidents, either in childhood or later, that prompted you to work specifically in the field of diversity and to become a trainer of diversity? Because like you said, you're a dancer, you write. So there are so many different avenues and pathways that you could have taken. What led you specifically to focusing on diversity?
Thank you for asking that, because I did not originally intend to focus on diversity. In the early days, that was not a category of professional life. And nobody used the word diversity the way they use it today.
Yep.
They didn't even use multiculturalism back in the day. So what is it that prompted me to continue my journey? Partly it was when I got to Harvard. I went to Harvard University and found that I was more unusual than I had thought. And I wanted to major in diversity in a way that really reflected my background and my interests, and that was in world religions. So the religious diversity, in other words. Unfortunately, back in the day, it didn't exist. So I went to the dean of Radcliffe College, and it was still separate. The women's college was still separate from the men. And I told her what I wanted to do. And I said, I know you don't have that kind of diversity course or major, but I would be happy to create it for you. She was not happy with me. She said, well, we took you because you were so interesting as a freshman. But now that you're here, you will major in economics or English like everyone else. Okay. Did I? No, I did not. What I found was that there was a brand new major called folklore and mythology. And it was basically the science of storytelling across different cultures. And it was married to cultural anthropology. And that's what I majored in. And it gave me the basis, right, for doing all the diversity work that I have done throughout my life. The storytelling aspect of it, oral history, some people may call it. But also because the science of storytelling pulls together huge amounts of data of cultures, I'm able to share that science with people with diversity. And it matched so much my interest in the arts. And it's been quite a journey. Now, I will say, right, that I wasn't content with just that. So I later got a master's degree in urban planning with a minor, if you want to call it, in arts and culture. How were you going to grow communities using the arts and culture for economic development? And that process, combined with cultural anthropology, right, has given way to creating my own invention, if you call it, of a cognitive diversity called the Matrix Model Management System, which is a process of sequential stages in which to train people to reboot their brain so that they can actually understand, not just follow guidelines, but understand cultural differences and how they can be impactful.
That's very interesting. And like you mentioned, obviously, when you were studying, you said that there was, you know, diversity wasn't spoken about like it is today. But even today, it's still, I would say, growing, right? It's still, people are still understanding what it means, why you need to talk about it, why is it important. So maybe if you could just elaborate a little bit on what is it really that you do in your work as a diversity trainer, like, What do you talk about? Who do you talk to? Yeah, if you can just maybe paint a picture of what does that look like for people who maybe still have heard the word, but aren't really familiar on where that fits in.
Sure. So the process that I invented, the Matrix Model Management System, starts off with the science of storytelling, because communication, the ability to communicate at that level, is so key to understanding each other. And it can be a story as short as a tweet on Twitter or as long as your favorite movie. But it does give you a way to communicate with people. And then you go on to the next stage, which is emotional intelligence. If you don't have the emotional intelligence to go with it, it doesn't work. And I know that emotional intelligence is kind of a buzzword these days, very much a fad. But when I started using it, I invented something called emotion metrics so that you could measure it, because I felt that it was too vague. It was too wishful thinking. And my background in computers, by the way, led me to be more mathematical about it. I should share with you that back in the 1960s, when computer programming basics of matrix algebra was first offered, I was in high school and my mother said, "You need to take this course." And I said, "Oh no, I'm going to be a poet, an artiste." And she said, "This is not a suggestion. You will obey." Okay. And so I started studying the complexity of computer programming back all those years. And I eventually became an IT manager at office. My goal was to be in the IT world, because at that office, I was actually in charge of the interreligious affairs. I was already working with religious diversity, putting on programs and speakers, conferences, right? But I was also the only person in the entire office back in the early 1980s who had ever laid hands on a computer. So I was designated whether I liked it or not. And perhaps that's fate in the world, that you marry all the different skills that you have, which is one of the pieces of advice that I have for young people. Nothing goes to waste. So in doing that, then what I also did was go to the decision-making part of the matrix system, because one of the things that I really wanted to underscore was this was not just theoretical. There had to be decisions made, and you had to go through the communication skills and the emotional intelligence skills before you made the decisions. Because people, they get panicky, "Oh, okay, we'll do this, we'll do that." They have no idea of the consequences of those decisions. So not only is the decision making, but it is the long range planning that I put together in this matrix system so that people could create a world in which the communications, the emotions, the team development, the leadership development, all of the above would flow together. And in doing that, it meant that the process could be applied to virtually any industry. So I have worked with organizations that are manufacturers, nonprofits that do civic work, healthcare organizations, a lot of healthcare groups, because it's the process is so flexible.
Right. That's very interesting. And do you have an anecdote or a story from either your early days working in the diversity space or even recent times that highlights the need and the importance, so that in a very tangible, concrete, like you mentioned, storytelling way, like you're able to see, here's why this matters. So do you have any like stories or incidents?
Let's see. There have been many stories that I have that where it has made such a difference. Let's take healthcare, for example. So here in where I'm living presently, Chattanooga, Tennessee, right in the southeast of the United States, we have many doctors, nurses, and patients from around the world. A lot of the people involved have no idea of how to treat these patients in terms of being culturally aware. What do you feed them? How do you deal in terms of different genders for men and women? What to expect? How do you deal with end-of-life issues? What is important to these people that you will pay attention to? How do you think about the issues of calendars and holy days that they need to be observed when they're in your care? And so all of these things, they come to me for answers. In the early days, they also came to me from education, from schools, with the very same questions. What do we do with these people, these youngsters and their families, their observations of holidays? What do they eat? All of these things. And so in the very early days, I created something called the Quick Reference Religious Diversity Cards. And in reality, they're just cultural cards, but I put them in several of my books. One of them is Religious Diversity for Schools, and another is Religious Diversity in the Workplace, so that people could see how to adjust and adapt, right, for different cultures, nationalities, ethnicities that go along with different faiths.
Right.
And one of the things that came up, it was funny, I got an email from someone saying, I finally realized how important your work is when our committee at the United Nations suddenly realized they had scheduled a meeting on a key holy day for several of its members and hadn't even checked the calendar. Thank you.
That's really interesting. And Deborah, there's something I'm very curious about when it comes to the work of diversity, inclusion, equity. I feel oftentimes the people who come forward and ask for training are already at some level aware or conscious, or they want to sort of get better at it, right? But there is also a whole host of people who don't feel it's important or are happy with status quo and aren't even reaching out, and maybe they need it more. So could you speak to anything that you've seen work or that you've done that builds that interest in having that conversation in a space that didn't exist earlier, especially in the context of today's polarized times, where I feel with social media, etc., religious diversity is just more negatively looked at and people are forming more and more separate groups rather than trying to work together. So I'd love to hear from you on that.
Religious diversity is just one aspect of what I do. And I really appreciate that many people are hesitant to get into the world of diversity in the first place, or if they're in it, they don't want to go further. I tell a joke when I start to train about a bunch of people being in the cafeteria of a corporation having lunch, and the manager arrives at the door and says, okay, folks, it's now time to go for diversity training. And everybody looks up, stands up, and runs for the door out into the parking lot, beyond the parking lot, into the lawn, beyond the lawn, into the forest, through the forest, to a cliff, and jump over the cliff. That's how much they're interested in diversity training. And of course, people laugh. And that's the key. I want people to have a good time in my training. And I design it so that they do. So that it doesn't just force people to talk about their difficulties, their challenges, their failures, their whatever. No, 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 no. I want them to start by just, for example, tell me your favorite music. And they all say, well, do you mean a musician or a song or a genre? And I said, I didn't say, did I? So you get to choose. And part of that choice will show the diversity among you before you even show us your answer. So I want them to understand how deeply embedded diversity is in each one of us. No one is the same as any other person on the planet. And we can actually enjoy that. So then, I go from there and what is your least favorite music? And so you start to build the emotion metrics from favorite to nightmare kind of thing. And we keep applying that so that people have a skill set and a common language in which to speak. Because all too often, you know, it's just a clash. And what's the point of that?
Right.
I have a very firm belief that if you do not document what you do, it's gone. And so that's why I have so many books, because there's documentation and how-to worksheets, workbooks attached to them, because I want my work to be sustainable and spread out. So many groups have picked up on these books and used them. I don't even know about it. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And you've done such interesting and very diverse work yourself, right? Like you mentioned, your study from computers to anthropology to folklore, being a dancer yourself, writer, trainer. There's just so much that you've done. What were those conscious choices to make, just do very diverse things? Or was it just organically, as opportunities came forward, you sort of picked it? How did all of that map out?
All of the above. The interesting thing about having so many interests and having followed them, right, is that passions were always there. I started, for example, dancing age 5 back in Bermuda, where they had folk dancing, square dancing outdoors during the summer and the evenings. My brother, older brother, would go and my parents would take me along. And I was fascinated by it. It's that curiosity. And I wanted to do it. And my mother took me to the manager. My daughter would like to. And he says, she's so young. I don't know if anybody's going to want to dance with her. So my brother paid his friend 6 pence to dance with me and take me off his hands. Thank you, Joe. And I was off and running. And do you know, to this day, I am still in contact through social media with some of the people I danced with all those years ago.
Wow.
Sort of a determination both to keep in touch with those that shared my passion and then to move on, because when I came to the States, I'm afraid that I tried to do what we call in ballet a grand jeté, a great leap off a slide, fell and broke my leg, and I was forced to go into something else besides dance for a while anyway. And that's when my parents decided to get me into playing the violin. So sometimes I've been forced to change direction. My health has always been an issue. So sometimes when I crash and burn because I overextend and it gets to me, I have to switch gears. I go to a different passion, but I never give up.
Lovely. And across all of these different things that you've done, when you think about like some of the biggest impact that you've had, what comes to mind? It could be numbers, it could be a story, but how do you think of your biggest impact?
It may be on my daughter, who has turned out to be a psychiatrist and helps people who are in dire need. But it's also, and we haven't talked about this before, my dad was a United States military intelligence officer during World War II. He was assigned to interrogate Nazi prisoners of war. I didn't know this until my own career path. In it, I chose to deal with the hate groups, with what was happening in terms of internal domestic terrorism. And so that's when he told me about what he had seen, and that he had kept all his notes, his letters, my mother's letters to him, in a file cabinet in his closet. Excuse me, you did what? I couldn't believe it. I'm like in my 40s and this is the first I'm hearing of it.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. So that was a start of a time for me to try truly to look at diversity in a way where communities can engage together, and people can dialogue together and not hate each other for the differences. It was more passionate than ever. And so I have continued that work, and I will be shortly broadcasting a script I've written with my parents' wartime letters so that people can see, hear what inspired me, right, to take, quite frankly, rather personal risks to do this work. And I've been trained in security by the FBI for good reason. And so I continue to do this work on diversity with a passion that will never leave me.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, finding out something like that at the age of 40, it can have an incredible impact.
Yes.
You did mention it sort of came at a time when there was some internal hate, domestic hell, you know, like hate that was happening. And you also mentioned right now that personal risks to yourself, like there have been many personal risks at the cost of which you've done it and been trained on security by FBI. Could you maybe share a little bit more of why? Like on the face of it, it's not something that's very obviously popping out. So what could you maybe elaborate on? What are the different risks or why the need to be trained on security?
Okay. So at the time I was working in the Chicago area, I was running a Jewish Federation in a place called Rockford, Illinois, a small city. And I was looking for my work in Holocaust history. And I started to write a script for a video for classroom education about it, because many of the survivors had settled in Rockford, Illinois, of all places. And I was telling my father about it, and that's when I started to get hints a little bit about what he knew. And then I saw that there was a job opening in Oklahoma, just after the Oklahoma City bombing. You may not be familiar with this, but it was a domestic terrorism event in the state of Oklahoma where domestic terrorists had blown up a building with people in it, ranging from children to professionals. And it was a very far-right group. I wanted to see what these neo-Nazis were doing my native soil, my home. And so I took that job. And I had exposure to a lot of things going on in this country that I had never imagined. And we had a statewide coalition to deal with the hate crimes that were coming up. And it was through the coalition that the FBI trained us on safety measures, both for my own company and its campus, and for anybody else who is diverse in the city. And we had quite a few, ranging from Native Americans, African Americans, Hispanics, you name it. None of us felt safe for good reason. There were flyers left on people's lawns claiming that we were subhuman and killing us was therefore not a crime. Those are the kinds of things we dealt with. And this was back in the 1990s. To see it rise again in recent years has been difficult. And to see me, myself, right, targeted online by some of these neo-Nazi groups has been educational, to say the least. And it is because of that I'm in touch with the FBI here locally. And I feel very grateful for the training, but also the support that I have in so many ways. This is a difficult time for all of us in an environment that's not just divisive, but quite violent. But at this stage in my life, I'm certainly not going to hide and shut up. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you for sharing that and those personal experiences. I think today the hate for or violence against any minorities, I think across the world, is just increasing. And for our everyday, daily life, for a regular person, what are some things that you feel might help all of us accept the diversity that exists around us instead of increasing and contributing to the hate and violence towards a group that doesn't feel similar to the majority, right? And I think this is happening across the world, whether it's language, religion, race, caste. So what are some things that maybe you would recommend to people to practice every single day?
What a question. So one of the things that has always been on my mind is through the arts, right? What is it that you can find in that community of people that are different from you? You know, whether it's music or dance or paintings, theater, fashion, architecture, you name it. There's so many ways in which people express their culture that you can enjoy, appreciate. And that's a good place to start. And it has always been something that corporations have done. They've often done, you know, cultural fairs where people bring food dishes from their culture to share and everybody gets to, you know, stuff their face. And it's wonderful, right? And the music and dance, it gives people a sense of who people are without getting into some of the more difficult issues that can come later. But if you can see something that's appealing there and maybe reach out to that artist, tell them you like, right? Say thank you. Start a relationship like that, just one-on-one. It gives humanity to the situation, not just appreciation of diversity. And that's what we're looking for.
Yeah. That's beautiful. And you mentioned, I think you've spoken about art and culture through this conversation, and there's a real power to the unification that comes from there, right? Like, you don't need to understand the language to appreciate whether it's music, film, art, architecture, like you mentioned. So I think that's a great starting point to both showcase for people who are interested in building that respect and admiration for diversity, and also an easier way for people to connect. So thank you for sharing that. I think I have one broad question on my mind, which is just from all your years of experience, different work that you've done, very exciting, fun, diverse. What's advice that you have for people listening who are also maybe walking on journeys where they want to like create change both within and outside? So what are some learnings or advice you'd like to share with them?
The process, you know, is ongoing. So it may start with just, as we said, exposure. Keep exposing yourself to the yoga cultures. You don't have to think of it as learning, not yet anyway. It's just, that's interesting. Oh, how about that? I didn't know that. And then choose somebody to emulate. Someone that you respect and admire and who is doing the kind of work you hope to do. Okay. Take a look at how their journey has been, what they've done, how they've learned about it, and what their successes and their challenges have been. That's okay. If you can contact them, that's great, but that's not always necessary or doable. And that's when you start to get yourself educated so you can be like them. And the training and the reading and the YouTube and you name it, to give you more information. And then don't forget the issue of emotional intelligence, right? Think how you're feeling as you see this. Be self-aware, and then you can be more aware of what other people are feeling. And if you're getting to the point where you're panicking, right, be aware of it, step back, breathe, and then start to rethink the way you're doing things. And then you can do the same for your team, because I can almost predict that it will come to that at some point. It'll just be too much for people. Mm-hmm. Know that and be willing to negotiate something that they can handle. That gives you a little bit more expertise, not just education, but the expertise. And the more you practice that, again and again and again, like any other art form, right? That's when you are able not only to make those decisions, but to plan. That's an elevated version of expertise. And that's when you become what I call a visionary. And that's what I think people should aim to be.
Wow, that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. And I know earlier you also mentioned something about not, like, nothing goes to waste, and how you've leveraged all the different experiences in your life and channeled it all together. So that was wonderful as well.
Well, I once put up a saying on Facebook that said, remember, every silly little thing you've ever done doesn't go to waste. Well, somebody picked that up, put it into one of those, you know, colorful things and put it up there and says, here are the words of wisdom of Deborah Levine. It comes down to that. Okay.
Yeah, but I really love that. I feel there's also a narrative which is like focus and everything should tie together and find that one thing that you want to pursue. And I think it's important to also have the other narrative of saying all things also add up and nothing goes to waste. So I think it's a really nice balance to that. Is there anything that we've not spoken about that you'd like to add before we close out?
I would like to just let your folks know that they can go online to the AmericanDiversityReport.com and see more than 1,000 articles by people all over the world talking about diversity, telling their stories, and giving people suggestions for what to do in the workplace or in the community. And it's all available to them. And should any of them want to write, and I encourage that always, there are submission guidelines. And I would love to have more thoughts, writing, and people who have a passion for diversity.
Lovely. I'm sure I'm definitely going to check it out, and hopefully people listening will as well. Thank you so much, Deborah. I think this has been such an interesting conversation to hear both your incredible personal journey as well as just talk more about the value of diversity. I'm definitely going to check out some of your books and frameworks as well. So thank you for sharing those.
My pleasure. Yes, the books are all up on the American Diversity Report too. And thank you for having me and doing this. I look forward to any feedback that your audience may have.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you liked this episode, do subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. We'd love to hear your suggestions, reactions, or even guest nominations. You can DM us on Instagram. Our handle is @anewkindofcelebrity, or email us at anewkindofcelebrity@gmail.com. We look forward to meeting you soon. Till then, good luck and take care.